support is made in part by the Bayside Diner, located in the Bristol Inn Hotel, open Monday through Saturday, 7 a.m. until 9 p.m., and Sunday from 9 a.m. until 7 p.m. More information at 842-1013 or online at baysidedinerak.com.
This is Bristol Bay and Beyond, KDLG's weekly news magazine. It's Friday, June 16th. I'm your host, Dave Benninger. Thanks for coming on board. This week, Robin Samuelson joins to talk about the coming fishing season and the latest on opposing the pebble mine.
We got to debate the issues and have the grown-ups make the decision whether that mine's going to go through. And we've got to do our work diligently in opposing the pebble mine.
We'll look at what it takes to put in RSW and why the investment still proves a tricky hurdle for some drift boat skippers. Our local growers and gardeners are off to a good start this summer, and another small business has had to make a move. Upopham Fireworks will not be at the harbor anymore.
Last fall, when I thought we weren't going to find a place to be, I was really upset. I couldn't figure how can I spend a 4th of July away from my fireworks stand.
Plus, NACNIC's Herc McDermott shares on just how busy the port of Bristol Bay is getting to be. Dr. Scott Rayborn breaks down how to use the port molar test fishery numbers, and Buck Gibbons of the Stevie K shares his vision of a change underfoot.
I can't imagine it not being on everyone's radar that we are in the middle of a revolution here, and we're going to be known for our quality.
Those stories and more coming up on a special one-hour edition as we put Bristol Bay and Beyond to rest for the summer and kick off our Sisyphean task of hosting the Bristol Bay Fisheries Report here on KDLG. First, a look back at some of the week's news. Alaska Governor Bill Walker has called the legislature back for a second special session to begin at 1 p.m. today after failing to pass an operating budget. Without a budget, the state government will shut down in 2 weeks. The House called it quits for the first special session Thursday night after pushing through an operating budget on short notice. The Republican Minority Caucus strongly protested. This morning, the more conservative Senate adjourned without acting on the House's budget. Democratic Senator Berta Gardner got the last word in before Republican Senate Pete Kelly gaveled out.
It's unacceptable to shut down without passing a budget, and we have to keep working at it. Thank you.
Thank you, madam. We are adjourned, sine die.
House leaders said negotiations with the Senate were not going well and that legal deadlines to adopt a budget compelled their unorthodox route to passing a budget. Fishing picked up in Bristol Bay this week with openers in Igooshik, Ugashik, and Igigik. The set and drift fleet in Igigik has put about 60,000 sockeye on the books this year, and the bay-wide catch is now closing in on 70,000 fish. Area manager for Igigik and Ugashik, Paul Solomon, said Thursday he will probably not fish again till Monday, but first wanted to see the Thursday and Friday morning catch.
Right now I'm inclined to take the weekend off, but if we get a big shot, I may rethink that. In Igigik and Ugashik, I'm less inclined to fish over the weekend. Certainly not in a rush to do it. We'll see what the weekend brings before we commit to anything further next week. So I guess the short message is folks should stand by at the usual announcement times after it closes, and that's when we'll get the word out if we decide to do something over the weekend. But it's not likely right now.
The Port Molar test fishery numbers showed an uptick Thursday. The Nooshgak King Run is so far lagging behind its escapement curve. Bristol Bay's small local longline fleet have now harvested about 61,000 pounds of halibut. BBDC's Gary Klein says there's still enough quota to fish till probably the end of June for those who want to.
Slightly over the 58,800 pounds of quota we have available in the 4E section. However, our local halibut fishers still have access to some of the 4D quota, which should be plenty enough to last for those that want to fish until the salmon season kicks off.
He says 21 boats have fished halibut locally this season. The Pebble Partnership announced Tuesday that it will be contracting with an Arctic Slope Regional Corporation subsidiary to help streamline its contracting with other village corps. Mike Heatwell is a company spokesman.
We were looking for someone who could assist us with ensuring that we can maximize the contracting opportunities for our business partners around the lake area. We've had long-term business relationship with a range of Alaska Native Village corporations around the lake area and wanted to get some additional assistance to make sure that that opportunity was fully realized for the long haul.
Contracting with ASRC drew swift backlash from the region, including from the Bristol Bay Native Corporation. Pebble says they intend to submit a plan for permitting within the next 2.5 years. Two Unalakleet men were killed in a boating incident this weekend, or rather this week. They were found dead Wednesday morning by search and rescue volunteers. Peter and Justin Nanook, aged 55 and 35, left for a fishing trip to St. Michael on Saturday morning. State troopers and U.S. Coast Guard searched for the uncle and nephew pair for several days using helicopter and ground crews. A spokesman for the Coast Guard said the two men were found by Wednesday morning. Anchorage police confirmed that 24-year-old Kyle Ray of Dillingham was the victim of a fatal stabbing outside of the Beans Cafe a week ago. APD did not name Ray until this week. In their original press release, they say he was stabbed just outside the Brother Francis Shelter and Beans Cafe, which is a popular hangout for homeless in the state's largest city. So far, police have not named any suspects. The Tustamina Ferry's return to service has been delayed again, this time now till the 15th of August. The date has been pushed back multiple times this year. The delay comes as fishing is getting underway along the peninsula and Kodiak. Rodney Intaglieta is the interim mayor of Chignik Bay, one of the cities served by the ferry. He says residents are frustrated.
Everybody's a little disgruntled about it. I wouldn't say a little either. This has been going on for about 4 or 5 years where there's been problems with the Tustamina. I think that the ferries should be a little embarrassed that they didn't have a contingency plan in effect for an emergency like this, knowing that the people down here and on the Aleutians rely on that ferry system.
The state says the delay is due to repairs on the ferry continuing to take longer than expected. Dillingham screen printer Brooks Spurlock opened Midnight Inks Gallery for local artists to sell their goods Tuesday night. She and her husband Jason Munster recently renovated their entryway into a display case.
It's a tiny space, but in here we have earrings made by Chanel Faux, and I have some toddler cuspucks from Robin Chaney. And then over here I have my apparel hanging. And then over here on the wall in these old fish row boxes, we've got some earrings from Natasha Johnson, etched glass from Erica Tweet. I have a fish wall hanging from Pat Walsh.
Other local artists featured include Ian Faux and Nancy Jenkins, and there were opening desserts made by other local artists. Midnight Inks Gallery is scheduled to be open Tuesdays in Dillingham. And finally, the City of Dillingham Council met last night, passing an amended version of the fiscal year 2018 budget. The new version included reinstating positions at the Library and Police Department. More on this week's news can be found at our website, kdlg.org. This is Bristol Bay and Beyond on KDLG. I'm Dave Benninger. We're using this week's show to kick off our fisheries coverage, better known as the Bristol Bay Fisheries Report, which will begin airing nightly starting Monday at 6 p.m. Consider today's show a bit of a hybrid between the two as we discuss the coming fishery alongside some of our usual slice of life stories. The 2017 season is underway with more than 66,000 sockeye now on the books here in the Bay. The state's estimate calls for a total run this year of 41.5 million, with 27.5 million available for harvest. That's down 26% from last year. Looking at pounds, the harvest is estimated at 148 million, which would be the smallest since 2013. Will the price go up a bit to accommodate the smaller harvest? Where will it go if it's not going in the can? Where will this year's hot spots be to fish, and will these Nooshigat kings start showing up next week? These questions and more we will explore in the Bristol Bay Fisheries Report. Robin Samuelson of Dillingham skippers the Robin Darlene and has been fishing the bay for over 50 years and delivers his catch to Trident Seafoods. Skipper, it's good to have you back in, and this is kind of our first fisheries report of the year, and it's an honor to have you sit down with us.
Well, thanks for inviting me in the number one slot.
Let me ask you before we even talk fishing. Pebble is just really ripping people apart, and I'm just picking up so much animosity between different village corporations and BBNC and shareholders and yada, yada, yada. It seems like everybody's pretty hot right now. What's the latest?
Well, that's part of the process. They got a little money. They've got a year to improve on developing a plan for the Pebble Mine. They're going to be buying as many people as they can, I still think we're going to win. That mine should not happen in that place, and I've talked to both sides of folks on the issue, I'm not mad at people that support Pebble, but I don't support the mine. I've never supported the mine, and I never will support the mine. We got to debate the issues and have the grownups make the decision whether that mine's going to go through. And we've got to do our work diligently in opposing the Pebble Mine. On a collective basis. And yes, there's going to be villages that support the mine. That's the village's business. I wish they wouldn't, but the village makes the decision. But I'm confident in the end that mine will not go through. And if it does go through, it's going to be very limited in scope what they can do to protect the fish species, to protect the land mammals and whatnot.
ASRC sort of wedged in here this week, and I heard a lot from a lot of folks about what that means or how it's being received. I'd ask you, you're on BB&C board. Some people said BB&C should have taken this and been practical or pragmatic, and other people said, I can't believe they'd come in our territory here or something. How do you read this move?
Well, I don't represent BB&C sitting here today. I represent Robin Samuelson.
Your opinion?
I was pissed.
All right.
Pebble Mine's the biggest issue that happened here since the high seas Japanese drift nets decimated our runs. Now we have a major threat up there. They haven't come and talked to the village people. It's not all about the almighty dollar, the George Washington, and it's our culture down here. How about if we went with the anti-whaling groups and approved anti-whaling and did everything within our region to stop whaling? What are they going to do? They're going to go absolutely nuts. And what comes around goes around.
Right.
And if they're going to treat us like a piece of crap, which they are, their time is coming. I just wish they would have stayed within their region and not got involved in this political battle. And that's what it is. This mine is a political. You look at John Shively and the people that are putting this thing together. It's nothing but a big political cash-paying cow to folks. And some people in some villages are making millions of dollars off it. They don't care about our fish species. They don't care about our culture down here. Yes, we need jobs in the region. We need employment throughout the region, especially in light of what President Trump is trying to do to rural Alaska, what the Alaska legislature is trying to do to rural Alaska. We got major problems facing us. And let me tell you, that mine is not going to be our savior.
Let's change topics here and talk a little bit of fish. You've been getting the boat ready all week here. Did you get those corks and buoys marked this year?
Absolutely. We've got them all marked real well for the fishing game officer when he boards us this year. The boat is running well.
RSW, right?
The boat has RSW on it.
This is new this year or
this
last?
This is new. I've been icing since the ice program went into effect. And pretty impressive, pretty simple machine to operate.
Okay.
I was reluctant. I'm not too on the mechanical side of things, but I could operate the RSW system. And, yeah, it looks like it's going to be a real addition to my boat. And, you know, the fishery's changing pretty fast here. A lot of companies are demanding that they want chilled fish, either iced or RSW fish, to improve the overall quality. We need to put up quality salmon in Bristol Bay. We need to face the challenges if we're going to stay in the industry. We've been in this industry 154 years.
So let me ask you about that. Where does this bay need to go in the next 10 or 15 years? Not the next board cycle, not just permit stacking and more net in the water and the same perennial issues. Where does the bay need to get in 10 or 15 years to keep up with these quality standards? Should there be bigger boats? Should there be less permits? Should there be fish traps like Medrid was arguing the other day in his little blog? What do you think?
Yeah, well, the reason why we became a state is because of fish traps. Right. That was the driving force to get rid of fish traps. And we'll never see fish traps in Alaska again, thank God. Information is changing in the cooling of salmon. It's getting more affordable. It's getting smaller. You have Ron Rossen boats out there with RSW in them today. And we have the ice barges out there. A lot of the companies pack ice on their tenders now. They want bleeding done. They want mats on the floor. They want 800-pound brailers. Before, we used to fill our brailers plumb full. Now we could only put 800 pounds in them. So the companies and the fishermen are changing to the market standards. And I think over the next 10 years, you're going to see a lot of changes, small changes that are going to have a very positive effect. What worries me the most over the next 10 years is the state of Alaska management of this fishery.
Okay.
Bristol Bay has lost managers, fish managers, have lost a lot of their tools.
Right.
And it's, by the grace of God, we have these 50 million, 40 million runs that are coming back. These are humongous runs. No right. place in the world is like Bristol Bay. And we need to have the biologists that are running these fisheries, we need to provide them with the right tools to continue on that scope. Watching the legislature this session, and the House adjourned last night, I guess, with their budget, and the Senate says they're not going to pass that. It's got me real concerned, and we're approaching July 1, and what's July 1 going to do to the fishery managers and the programs that we have in effect?
Right.
And that may have a long-term effect on our fisheries out here, and that really worries me.
Even just the slow whittling away of projects that may not make sense to somebody in the Capitol, but making sure these towers are getting accurate long-term data, and the rest seems pretty key.
Absolutely.
Well, it seems there's a story every year to the fishery. You know, either the run is big and late, or it's the 2 billionth fish, or something like that. What will be the story this year in your mind? What do you predict?
I don't know. You know, I've been watching the South Peninsula fisheries. They had a fantastic opening down there.
Really cracking along, yeah.
And the fisheries dropped off.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of puzzling.
Ours is a little slow to get going here.
And the Kings now are holding off entering the river. I talked to Tim Sands this morning. There's about 1,500 apportioned up the river on Kings. And, there's a lot of reds and dogs showing up in the subsistence catches, my wife's net, and other nets along the beach. But the King's been holding back. And, of course, we haven't had a good 25 southeast wind.
Right.
But we need some wind to get them Kings up there because we need to sustain that run.
Be interesting to see what happens this season. Otherwise, I think there's a little bit of optimism. Do you share that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, I was reading an article the other day. The average price of wild sockeye has increased 45% over last year. And same with farm fish. It's increased. So I'm optimistic. I'm optimistic on run. I'm optimistic that we're going to get a raise in fish prices this season. It's funny. In another month, we'll know whether that happens or not. But my uncle Boyson Olson used to tell me, "Never rely on fishing game. You'll know it's a good season, Robin, when you're on your way to the bank." After the season, you got money to deposit. It's been a good season.
Robin Samuelson, it's good to have you in. We hope to have you back for a recap at the end. Thanks for making time. Good luck this season.
Thank you.
My name is Ray Thayer. I'm on Wild Thing. I used to own a 60-foot sailboat. Well, I had intentions of joining a race called BOC, which is a single-handed race. The boat sank.
So what got you into commercial fishing?
my sailboat sank and I was home twiddling my thumb wanting to do something. You go nuts if you don't have something to do. And I'd always read about Bristol Bay, so I thought I'd give it a try.
As good a reason as any good to hear from you, Ray. More voices from NACNEC throughout the program today, and we hope to hear from many of you throughout the season. Give us a call here at the station or send an email to fish@kdlg.org. We want to know what's happening where you're at. Refrigerated seawater systems are rapidly becoming standardized here in the Bristol Bay Drift Fleet. Last year, gillnetters in the bay delivered more chilled fish to processors than ever before, and with the high cost and logistical challenge of making and distributing ice, companies may soon expect their fishermen to have RSW on board. But with the high cost and hassle of installation, making the upgrade is still a tough thing to do. KDLG's Nick Shalino has more.
Refrigerated seawater systems circulate water from the ocean through a system of pipes into a chiller. The water is pumped into a vessel's fish hold to chill the catch at just above freezing. This helps to preserve the fish without needing ice, but some of the fishermen in Bristol Bay have older boats not equipped with the chilling systems, and it is a costly upgrade.
It is a very expensive project and very time-consuming, so you either have to ship it down south and have somebody else do it or get it in your backyard and work on it all winter. So that's one thing, and then cost is another. It's not cheap.
That's Dan Corthius, captain of the Utnapishtim. He will not be fishing with an RSW system this season and doesn't expect to have one installed for at least a couple years.
I'll probably buy the unit next year, but I probably will not install it till a year after. I have to do some welding on the deck there and get another hold set up so that I can put it in and have enough room for it and still chill enough fish and still make it easy to fish. So it's a lot of work.
Doug Cannon is a technician and part owner at Marine Refrigeration Solutions, one of several Bristol Bay companies who specialize in RSW. He says this apprehension is common with skippers who have older boats.
People have a desire to do it the traditional way. They don't want change. They're afraid of change. And if there's fear of a new piece of equipment, you don't want it in your boat. Because you don't know how it works, you don't know what it does. It's a piece of magic.
All boats and fishing operations are different, so both the installation schematic and total cost of an RSW unit are extremely variable. Marine Refrigeration Solutions offers consultation services and educational classes for fishermen who are looking to make the upgrade. Co-owner Mendy Jenkins says some fishermen who take the project on themselves end up paying more in the long run because of improper plumbing.
A good 80% of problems with RSW is because of poor installation, and having your water plumbing not designed properly.
Dan Corthius on the Utnapishtim is facing this very challenge as he plans to install a unit himself.
Everybody's done it a different way, and you find out which way is the best for insulating the holds and returns and all that stuff, and which unit they like the best and what the cost was. And so, yeah, get as much information as you can so you do it right the first time.
Several industry organizations in the Bristol Bay fishery are pushing for a higher quality of fish sold to processors, as market indications show a demand for fillets, not canned salmon. The task of chilling the fish and handling them properly falls on the fishermen. To chill fish, they can either install an RSW or use ice, which is not always accessible. Bristol Bay Regional Seafood Development Association Executive Director Becky Martello says processors are not showing an interest in distributing more ice to the fleet.
We offered up $150,000, these one-third grants per se or subsidizations, so that people could either buy new ice-making equipment or refurbish older equipment, and also to purchase insulated ice totes so that they could distribute ice further. And honestly, there just wasn't a ton of interest.
But there are incentives for fishermen to install RSW. Bonuses for chilled fish are increasing relative to the base price of salmon. Help with transportation costs is more readily available. And there are tax breaks for some fishermen who make the upgrade. Dan Corthius says he looks forward to getting RSW and is pleased entities in the Bay are pushing to put out a higher quality product.
The better fish we pull out of here, the more money we get. And I'd like to be able to say, you know, hey, that's Bristol Bay fish down here. I caught that thing.
82% of the chilled catch last year was chilled with RSW. Many in the Bay would like to see the entirety of the catch chilled with RSW in just a few years. In Dillingham, I'm Nick Shalino.
This is Bristol Bay and Beyond, special one-hour edition this week. Thanks for staying with us. A good place to come to grips with how big this fishery is the port of Bristol Bay. Huge numbers of empty shipping vans are stacked waiting for the catch. Robert Herc McDermott is the port director and joins me now. Herc, it's good to talk to you here. I know you guys are busy, so a few minutes of your time is precious, but thanks for making time.
Yeah, thank you. No problem. Well, we're extremely busy, like I said, more than ever before. We're definitely an optimistic bunch. we've got about 1,800 reefers in the bay so far, and I think about 1,600 of them are at our facility right now, waiting for a good time to distribute into the surrounding region. And the AML is working hard to get them all out to everyone before they need to fill them. And like I said, we're an optimistic bunch, and we're looking forward to having those fish numbers be strong like they have been in the past few years.
One thing I would wonder if you've noticed is how many more reefer vans are coming in and back out than used to versus the regular vans that used to go out with the cans in them?
Well, that's certainly true. We're down with the canned salmon is down, but it's one for one. Every canned salmon down, we're filling a reefer. So it's had a successful catch, and just because it's going frozen instead of canned, I mean, I think the value is there with the frozen. So it benefits everyone.
Yeah, that's what we've been hearing sort of from most of the stakeholders, that this is just kind of suggesting this change is all going in the right direction. That's kind of visible just to drive by the port of Bristol Bay. Just in the past couple of years, you just see so many more reefer vans there ready and waiting, mm-hmm. and then fired up and running as they're waiting to go back out there in July and August. Or how many do you think you'll put across the dock this year?
Oh, boy, I'd like to say that, anything above 1,500 will be a success. We were at 1,800 last year with 900 additional canned salmon, 20-foot containers. So, if we get anywhere around 1,500, it's going to be very successful for all.
One more question for you, Herc, is I had heard from Naknek Electric that as people moved into more fillet and freezing production, that it was definitely drawing a lot more power. I don't know if tell me how that plays in at the port.
Well, it's actually, we're okay down there. It's just putting a real strain on Naknek Electric to provide the power necessary to keep all the units cold. Last year we had 850 units running. Only 220, I believe, were running on shore power, and the remainder of the 850 were running on gensets. And I would like for them to provide the power for the other reefers just so that our community benefits from it. But they're working hard to put in place the infrastructure to have that power available to keep them frozen. So we're looking forward to that.
It's definitely a part of the story of what's happening here with this change in product forms. Last question is, you've probably been running 24/7. How many crew do you have, and what do you guys, what's it look like to folks? How do you paint a picture of how busy the Port of Bristol Bay is here?
Oh, boy. I believe we are at 18 employees. I could always use a few more. but we've done this barge that we're doing today. That's the 29th or 30th barge. I apologize. I might be one off, but we have been extremely, extremely busy. That's a good problem to have, although we could use some more crew.
Herc McDermott is the port director at Bristol Bay, one of the nation's busiest, of course. And Herc, we wish you and your crew a good, successful season here, and hope everything goes well.
Wish everyone else a safe season also, and thanks for your time.
Will you load 16 tons? What do you get? Another day older and deeper in debt. St. Peter, don't you call me, 'cause I can't go. I owe my soul.
to the company store.
My name's Michaela Wilson, and I am a barista here at Shearwater.
My name is Anna Hansen, and I'm also a barista.
Since I've been working here, it's definitely picked up a lot since the beginning of June.
What's your most popular item right now?
Probably an iced white mocha.
With caramel and coconut. They love them. It's mostly the guys, too.
Still to come, a trip to Unicorn Gardens in Dillingham and a primer on making use of that Port Molar test fishery data. UPOPM has been a fixture of Dillingham 4th of July and New Year's celebrations since 1993. Year-round residents and seasonal workers alike can easily find the firework, could easily find the firework stand down at the boat harbor. But this year it has a new home. KDLG's Avery Lill sat down with co-founder Billy Benedict to find out more about the move and her 24 years in the fireworks business.
Billy Benedict and Paul Peck opened UPOPM in 1993. A previous fireworks stand had just left town. The two, who have been friends since childhood, saw a need and felt the draw of a little extra cash. They rented the spot at the harbor, and that's where they've opened up shop twice a year for the past 23 years. But this year, things are a little different. The city foreclosed on the property where UPOPM rented space and gave notice that the fireworks stand would have to move.
It took us a long time to find a place to be, but it's a good location. It's down across from the soccer field and what we used to call the small airport. It isn't difficult to get to, and it's recognizable. So I think it'll be a good place. I'm sure that the local people will figure out where we are.
In nearly a quarter century of operation, this is hardly the first obstacle UPOPM has run into. There was the normal learning curve that comes with opening a new business.
We operated out of a tent the first year. We had to load the product, take it to the tent, set it up, and at the end of the day, load it up, take it back. And so every single day we had to set up. It was a lot of work. But we learned a lot. We learned a lot about what people like and what they don't like, about what they will spend money on and what they won't, what women like, what men like, what kids like.
And then there have been the rural Alaska-specific obstacles, transportation chief among them.
Our biggest problem is that we have to order in time to make the barge. I have to make the barge that doesn't sail any later than the first week of May, or my product won't get here in time. And then I have to order for New Year's by the last barge.
Benedict also has to take into account the copious summertime light when she orders for the 4th of July.
Well, you know, we have the problem in the summertime when it's light all day long, all night long, and the best we get really is twilight. And so mostly in July, they like things that are noisy. I would say that our biggest sellers are artillery shells and rockets in July. And just opposite is true in New Year's. We sell a lot of the night displays.
On the other hand, when it isn't light, it's cold. Benedict says the hours stretch long when she's selling fireworks in sub-zero temperatures ahead of New Year's Eve.
It's really, really a tough time for us to be open because we're not allowed to have any kind of heat source in the stand. So it's just us and the elements, hoping my fingers will work again.
When Peck and Benedict opened UPOPM in that tent in 1993, she didn't anticipate that it would become a regular part of her life for decades. But she says it's the people that keep her coming back.
I have so much fun doing it. I just have a great deal of fun having people come in and meeting them and talking with them and seeing what they pick out. And a lot of them come every year, so we know each other and have a relationship, business, but still a relationship. Last fall, when I thought we weren't going to find a place to be, I was really upset. I couldn't figure how can I spend a 4th of July away from my fireworks stand?
UPOPM fireworks have worked their way into the fabric of Dillingham festivities. Every July 4th and New Year's Eve finds many in the community on Kanakanak Beach setting off fountains, sparklers, rockets, and smoke bombs. Benedict says that's a constant in good times and bad.
I remember one 4th of July. We had a really, really bad fishing season. It was the evening of the 4th, and the fleet was being allowed to fish for the first time, long about 9 o'clock, they gave the fishermen the go-ahead. Everybody was rushing around, getting their gear on board, jumping on their boats and putting out on the tide. And then off in the distance in Kanaknak Beach, all these fireworks were going off. And the sun was low on the horizon, so it was just that twilight light. It was the most amazing thing. I will never forget that. Just seeing the fishermen going off to sea to fireworks in this beautiful weather.
UPOPM started selling on Thursday at their new location by the Dillingham Water Tower. They'll be open in the afternoons around 3 p.m. every day until July 5th. In Dillingham, I'm Avery Lill.
John Urey, Kodiak's home for all of us. I started up here in 1985 in the salmon fishery. The gentleman this went out of the fishery years ago, and it's gone. It's turned into a me fishery. Everybody thinks they got a new angle. It's funny to watch. I can be a gentleman, and I am. If they want to act weird, I can get weirder than they do. Doesn't matter to me.
Mackenzie Keeling Garcia. Technically, I'm a deckhand. I'm 24, and I made my first trip when I was 4 months old. So this is the Aquila, and we tender for Silver Bay Seafoods. It's been pretty fun. I think we're all really excited, and everybody kind of feels like we're all dressed up with nowhere to go kind of thing, because it's still pretty early in the year. Hopefully, the fish show up soon.
And those voices are brought to us by KDLG's Caitlin Tan, who will be reporting from Naknek throughout the season. If you're a faithful listener but are not directly tied to the fishery, well, we know that some of the numbers and data and announcements that fill our airwaves in the summer may seem at best strange or more likely just pretty dull at times. Right now, all eyes are on the catch numbers out of Port Moeller. As the Pandalus makes its out-and-back trips across the transect, I asked Dr. Scott Rayborn to give us all a primer on what that project is all about and how to make use of that daily data.
It started in the late 60s, but it was standardized with respect to the stations fished and the fishing protocol around 1987. And today we fish six stations each day, stations 2 through 12. The first station is about 10 miles offshore, the station 2, and then all the way out to station 12, which is about 85 miles offshore. And the boat fishes these stations. They stop at each one and set a gill net for about 20 minutes, and then steam to the next station. They fish out, and then they spend the night out at station 12, and then fish back in the next day. And a little bit about the net. Historically, the net was just four 50-fathom panels of 5 1/8-inch mesh, but that was selected towards Ocean Age 3 fish, and we removed two of the panels and replaced it with alternating 4 1/2-inch mesh and 5 1/8-inch mesh. And by doing that, that sort of equalizes the selectivity for Ocean Age 2 and Ocean Age 3 fish. We did that in 2011. And then we've been fishing for 20 minutes at each station since 2015. And that allows us to add station 12 to the end of the fishing transect. It saves time and also removes the possibility of the net getting fouled and not fishing properly or possibly gill net saturation. So that's a little bit about how the test fishery works. And the idea is that as the fish pass Port Moeller, catches start to build, and then it takes them anywhere from 5 to 12 days sometimes, generally 6 to 9. Hopefully we can narrow it down, the travel time, but it takes about that many days for them to reach their respective fishing districts. And starting around June 20th, you'll have enough catch and escapement, depending on whether the run is early or late, to relate those catches to what's going to show up inshore that many days later. And then as Port Moeller peaks and then declines, then you start to know, get a really good indication of what run timing might be, and then speak to run timing inshore as well.
Or if it double peaks like it did, what was that, 2014? Probably would not have been known without Port Mueller's catching on to that out there.
Yeah, sometimes it throws you off because it'll peak between the 20th and 25th and then just keep declining, and it's indicative of an early run. And then sometimes there's a lull, and then it peaks again around between June 30th and July 6th. And then you have a second part of the run like we did in 2015, 2016. So, yeah, those are all things to watch for.
Scott, let me ask you your best take on stations corresponding with fishing districts. I know there's a lot to it. It's not just as simple as people might think, but how do you read into them from where you sit?
Yeah, I wish I could say that all fish going to, say, the Eagle District came through station, fill in the blank, but it's not that simple. First of all, the run in general shifts back and forth across the fishing transect. And then with, let's say you're talking about a given district, that district will be spread across given the fishing transect. But there are some detectable patterns. In general, the gastric fish tend to pass mostly through stations 2 and 4. And they probably have the strongest pattern across the transect. But, you know, like last year, we saw a good many out at station 12 late in the year. But nevertheless, they tend to be distributed towards the other stations. Eagit tends to be spread more evenly across all stations than any of the other districts. That's not to say that the same number of fish pass stations 2 as pass 6 and 12. It's just that the proportion of the catches tend to be evenly distributed across stations. And then your Nakna, Kwejak, Nishkat Wood, of course, tend to be distributed more towards the outer stations, station 6 through 12. But then again, they can be have more of a flat distribution similar to Eagit. They just tend to be a little more skewed to the outer stations. And I know that sounds vague. It is vague, but that's about as good as we can say it.
Well, there's a lot of interesting info that comes in through the season when the genetic work is done, and then you start to see the inshore timing take shape, and your colleagues at FRI start sort of graphing out their version of whether a run is coming early or late. But the reason why I want to talk to you today is for the skippers out on the water who don't have the internet to look at these graphs and such. Tell me how you would read these numbers that come in, and they get relayed through KDLG, and we have your interpretations and such. But tell me what they should be looking for.
Yeah, of course, as the numbers build, it's indicative of more fish coming. And so catches, let's say you have a situation where catches really increase at Port Mueller. Well, that's good news, but how good a news, we don't know. And when that news is going to hit inshore, we don't know. Because the travel time between Port Mueller and inshore seems to change from year to year, and then it also seems to sometimes adjust in season. Fish might stop short of fishing districts and mill for a while before moving on in. And so that may increase or decrease. And then also how many fish inshore that a fish caught at Port Mueller represents, not, we term that the fish per index, but that can change throughout the season as the run is sometimes more exposed to the fishing transect than at other times. But in general, as catches increase at Port Mueller, you can expect them to increase inshore. Sometimes they increase more than you would expect, sometimes less. But one thing you usually can count on is that no fish at Port Mueller is bad. It's really good at detecting no fish. So catches really drop off. They're probably really going to drop off inshore. And they seem to be building, of course, as we would expect at this point in the season. And right now there's no indication of whether the run is extremely early or extremely late. In recent years, we've had record early and record late years. 2013 was one of the earliest on record and then last year in 2015 as well were two of the latest on record. Right now, things seem to be clicking along. You'll learn to use all of
And that was Dr. Scott Rayborn with the Port Moeller Test Fishery Project. This is Bristol Bay and Beyond on KDLG.
To be. To be.
And again, this week's show is a special one-hour edition as we transition from Bristol Bay and Beyond to the Bristol Bay Fisheries Report. But right now, let's turn from sea back to shore for this next piece. Growers and gardeners are hard at work getting their fruits and vegetables going in our less-than-ideal climate. KDLG's Allison Molenkamp visited one this week to see how her season is going.
Patricia Trite's masterpiece, Unicorn Gardens, is an island of organization in an otherwise unruly sea of dandelions. The neat rows house all sorts of fruits and vegetables. When I arrive, she's planting.
Mostly the coal crops, trying to get the last of those in. Broccoli and cauliflower I got in a couple days ago.
Those cold crops are just part of the vast garden. There's an entire small field of potatoes, two apple trees, two greenhouses, and assorted fruits and vegetables squeezed around the edges of it all. It didn't happen overnight. Trite's been building this garden for a while.
35 years, maybe? So the greenhouse is new, though it's... I think this is its seventh year...
The greenhouse looms large over the garden, and Trite had help to get it there.
It's through that Department of Agriculture program that they partially subsidize it. This one, they pay by the square foot, and I wanted something a little sturdier than some people claim to have made money on the program by buying cheapo ones, but those aren't working anymore either, so...
The greenhouse lets Trite control the environment for her plants better. It's allowed her to expand what she sells.
Anyway, this has made a whole difference in what I grow and what... It's made it possible to produce more starts, so I sell garden starts now that I really couldn't have produced that many before I had this available. So I can get them out here, and even when it's still freezing in here, I've got that box I can put them in.
In Dillingham, it's hard to know when plants may be safe from frost.
I won't say there's ever a last freeze or a first freeze, but usually you can count on nothing hard. In June and July, I start getting suspect in August. It's starting 1st of August, but we've had years recently where you can get clear through August without a frost, which makes a huge difference.
From a combination of climate change and El Nino, summers have been getting warmer and longer in southwest Alaska lately, which means Trite is finding more is able to grow in her garden.
I keep having to remind myself that, yeah, things that wouldn't grow here 30 years ago might now, or ones that barely survived then might survive better now. So I try to keep trying new stuff.
She's even started trying apple trees, but was recently reminded the weather isn't the only hazard out there.
A little bear got in here. Yeah, I don't know if it's a little bear or a big bear, but it broke this branch clear off. It was just kind of hanging by its bark, so I don't know, you know.
Is that what the tape is?
String and duct tape.
Bears aren't the only unwelcome visitors to Trite's garden.
You got the broken down part of my fence? Yeah, a moose walked through there the other day. There's a matching broken down part of my fence over there. Yeah.
While Trite perhaps wishes the local wildlife wouldn't enjoy her vegetables so much, she appreciates watching the impact of her garden for the area's human population.
It really does my heart good. I've got kids that came out here on field trips in the second grade and got introduced to fresh vegetables, and now they're bringing their kids to farmers market, which is just, you know, it makes me feel really good.
Some of those kids may not have known about fresh vegetables because gardening is more difficult here in Alaska. Towards the end of my visit, Trite reminisced about easier days of gardening.
When I was growing up, we lived about half a mile from a dairy, and for. You could get all the free cow manure you wanted, and for $5, they'd bring you a dump truck load of it and dump it in your garden for you. I think about that now and go, oh, please.
With no cows in Dillingham, Tridy has learned to be creative.
Oh, I've got my secret ingredient this year, too. Two big presets. Porky Poo cave that's got porcupines frequented. I'm not sure if they winter in it or if they just pup in it or what, but they've been pooping in it for about a century or so from the looks of it.
Summer spent gardening in Alaska won't be an easy one, but like her fishing neighbors, Tridy will muster up plenty of elbow grease. That effort will pay off to make Unicorn Gardens a patch of paradise this summer. For KDLG, I'm Allison Mollenkamp.
And finally this week, to round out our hour, last Saturday, the Bristol Bay Regional Seafood Development Association held its annual preseason members meeting, this time in Dillingham. Board member Buck Gibbons, who has fished the bay for 41 years and captains the Stevie K, is a passionate advocate for raising the quality of deliveries in Bristol Bay. Before he headed back to Naknek, I invited him over to discuss.
Yeah, I think we're finally seeing the tractor pull kind of diminish and the market-driven dynamics rise to the top, and we've created this incredible domestic marketplace where practically every retailer offers fresh and frozen sockeye salmon, from the big box stores all the way down to the little local grocer. It's a wonderful development that has given us a new sense of what we do. I think, you know, we're not just a commodity anymore. It's not cannery grade. We're seeing the canning lines slowly shut down and fresh and frozen and fillets kind of flourish. And I think our best days are in front of us.
You work at kind of a nexus where you keep close contacts with processors and retailers and things like that. You've mentioned in some meetings here that you've seen companies in their can lines and invest very heavily in their fresh and fillet production capabilities. Can you elaborate a bit?
Well, yes. We're seeing, like we said, and it's been noted in public before, that a lot of these companies are winding down their canning operations because the margins in fresh and frozen and fillets are considerably better.
I think we know of Red Salmon, Ocean Beauty, and Peter Pan this year, correct?
Yeah, okay. That's a lot of volume now that's got to go somewhere else. And probably elevates the sense of urgency on quality, because a lot of this fish is going to go out fresh. And if we're going to go to all the trouble to ship a fresh fish halfway across the country to where it's opened up on a fillet line at a distributor or a retailer and it doesn't perform well, we're right back where we started. I mean,
you say there have been tens of millions invested in Naknek in the past 2 or 3 years, or even the past 1 year on this. What do you know?
We know that Silver Bay is going to double their fillet capacity by 2018. That represents about a $10 million additional investment. We know that Trident Seafoods is going to invest close to double that in their North Naknek facility to install additional freezing and fillet operations. And with that investment, there's also been a mandate for their fleet to chill their fish at the point of harvest. So when that fish does get to that new investment that Trident has created, those fish perform at a proper level that's suitable for the new value-added reality.
The impetus is on the fleet, then, to bring their tender, a good quality fish. This is something the RSDA has become a very forceful advocate for. But the market itself has sort of helped encourage drift boat captains to deliver their catch chilled. We saw 71% of drift deliveries last year, and what was a big year came in chilled. What does that tell you?
Well, it tells me two things. First of all, for me personally, I'm not so sure about the 71%.
Okay.
Because I've found that unless you can have third-party verification of this at the point of delivery, it may not be quite as accurate as we would like. This year you're going to see quite a an uptick in onboard quality QCs. Control people to trust but verify those deliveries, where most fishermen now are going to get a report card on every delivery. Whatever the criteria is established by a particular processor, they're willing to pay for those. They're willing to incent their fishermen to elevate their quality, but they also want to verify that at the point of delivery. And I think it's about time that, you know, rather than pass the buck over to the other guy and try to, you know, point the finger at others, I think we need to take personal accountability ourselves, and getting a report card at the point of delivery isn't such a bad idea.
All right. All right. That incentive has become a point that cannot be ignored anymore. If you're a production guy and you really want to do your 250,000 pounds of deck loaded round hauled fish on the line or something, it's going to come to a point where a 30-cent difference cannot be overlooked.
No, and you have to find a way to do both, because this is a volume fishery, but you have to develop the culture on your boat to also handle with care. And many folks have found that sweet spot of both. And a lot of it was done with incentive, financial incentive. It certainly was with me. I'd be one of the first guys to say that I couldn't bleed and float all my fish. But when the financial incentives were installed, I got religion really quick. And now it's part of the culture on our boat. We can't imagine not doing it.
It's a culture on the boat. It needs to spread if it's going to be bay-wide. Is it spreading? Is it catching that Bristol Bay is not going to be a cannery fishery?
I think it's obviously spreading by the level of incentives that some of the processors are starting to distribute for quality initiatives. And it's no secret that the differential between dry fish and chilled, bled, floated product, that gap is widening in a pretty dramatic way. So I can't imagine it not being on everyone's radar that we are in the middle of a revolution here, and Bristol Bay quality is going to be, we're going to be known for our quality here real soon, as opposed to some cannery grade culture. I'm even trying to check my own vocabulary and not refer to these companies as canneries anymore. I want to refer to them as processors, because the sooner we can put the canning in our rearview mirror, for the most part, I think we'll all be rewarded handsomely to become more market-driven.
Organizations such as the BBRSDA that you're a member of the board for, there's BBEDC and other groups that, primarily those two probably, that invest heavily in projects and things around the bay. What are you doing? What do you think the solutions are to help others make the leap into better, whether they need more ice, whether they want to invest in RSW? What's the solution?
It's not going to come from one organization. It's a collaboration of all the stakeholders, everybody doing what they can individually, so that collectively the skids are greased for this conversion of sorts. We're seeing the Bristol Bay Borough government just recently passed a RSW tax credit, which is huge. That showed some serious leadership, because they're a big stakeholder in this thing, and for them to do that, I hope by virtue of that, we can convince other municipalities around here to do the same. It's simple math. I mean, their tax base is, do you want your tax base to be based on a 75-cent a pound fish, or do you want your tax base to be based on $1.20 per pound fish? You're going to get 3% of either one. You choose. The math was pretty compelling. So it just took a little bit of pointing that out to inspire everyone, and they're inspiring us now. So I'm thrilled with what these folks have done.
When you talk about this revolution that's underway, you know, there's a lot of leadership in this fishery and in Bristol Bay, but I wonder if John Lawrence isn't maybe sort of one key figure that's helped to bring to this point. What would you say about that?
I would say Like I've always said about John, he revolutionized his fishery and he never fired a shot. He is the he's the one that started it all, and his legacy is bigger than him now, and it's being plagiarized by practically every other processor up here. There's no barrier to entry to taking care of your fish properly, you know. And he demonstrated that to us. And he also demonstrated to us that as fishermen, we need to own our quality, because it's the only thing we do own. At some point we transfer title to this fish, and when it goes across to the tender, it's out of our hands at that point. And it's probably the most important thing we can do on our boat is to own our quality.
2017, are you optimistic? What do you think about the run size and the value and the way the fishery's taking shape here?
Well, when things look this good, there's always a curveball, and I don't know where it's coming from. But I've at least tempered my enthusiasm. And as a fisherman, I do know this, that my job is to get prepared appropriately. I don't want to break down, and I want to catch as many fish as I possibly can. And then the market, so I need to worry about those issues. The market will kind of almost take care of itself. I don't really have much influence over that, but I have influence over my personal operation and my maintenance and my making good decisions every day on the water.
Buck Gibbons of the Stevie K, who will be down in Ugashik, we suspect, for most of the season.
They send my mail down there.
And we hope to keep in touch with you while you're fishing. Buck, thanks so much.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
That's it for this week's show. We will bring Bristol Bay and Beyond back after the summer, but we'll switch gears now to the Bristol Bay Fisheries Report, which starts Monday night at 6 o'clock with replays at 10 and 2 a.m. and early shows at 1:30 on Saturday and Sunday. Keep in touch with us this summer by calling the station or emailing fishornews@kdlg.org. My thanks this week to Avery Lill, Caitlin Tan, Nick Shalino, and Allison Mollenkamp. And I'm Dave Benninger. We're looking forward to another exciting summer with you in Bristol Bay. And we'll see you back here Monday night at 6 o'clock.